I'm Cass Sutherland.
And I'm John Watt, and this is Listening to the Dead, live at CrimeCon 2023. And for this special episode, we're going to walk the walk and talk the talk about forensic gait analysis. And we're joined here by what is can only be described as a sort of forensic superstar with an entry in the Guinness Book of Records and a fictional character named after him. It's Dr. Hayden Kelly. Welcome, Hayden. Now, Hayden is an internationally renowned pioneering expert on forensic gait analysis. He literally wrote the book on it. It's called Forensic Gait Analysis. In 2000, he made legal history at the Old Bailey when gait analysis was first admissible as expert evidence in criminal law. He also features, as we said, as Hayden Kelly in crime thriller author Peter James's fictional Roy Grace series. Well, there you go. I mean, that's where we've got to start. How on earth did that come about, and how does it feel to be immortalised? Are you really here? Is this you?
It has been raised in court before now, literally. I'll get to that in just a moment. But Peter and I met, must be about 12 years ago. I always recognised that the subject was going to be, would enter into, or probably would enter into crime fiction at some point. And my hope was that it would always be written as authentically as possible. And he did that marvellously. If you haven't read the book, Not Dead Yet, in the Dead Book series, it's written for Roy Grace, then that one, there's a huge twist in it, which you'll find amusing, I'm sure. So it was a fortuitous meeting, and it just rolled from there, and I've appeared in a dozen books since by name. So he asked me if I wanted to, and I said, yes, that's fine. On one occasion in court, I can remember a defence barrister in cross-examination literally bringing the book up and saying, you're a fictional character, aren't you, Hayden Kelly? You're a fictional character, holding the book there. And so I just let him carry on and exhaust himself until the judge intervened and said, well, what is your question for Mr. Kelly? We need facts, not commentary. So that was how it evolved in that aspect.
Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I think we're all going to go back and read those now. We'll view the character in a different light. Linda, using experts in your book, I mean, have you been doing that for years as well?
Yes, and I've always tried to research, you know, direct to source. And I'm quite ashamed to say I had never heard of this type of investigation. It's completely new to me. Apart from the fact that going a long time ago, when I was at drama school, we had a specific teacher who came in, I think he's Swedish, it was called the Larman theory. And what he broke down, it was absolutely for an actor to say, I'm portraying a mechanic that all day is swinging one right arm. His body will therefore take on that pressure of movement and give it the rest of the body, so he will always move heavily from the right. But the reality is, probably all those years ago, it was part of, if I'm right or wrong, of what you do. Is that right?
In a broader sense, yes. I mean, in the context of how a person walks, I mean, gait is the style or manner in which a person walks. And forensic gait analysis is the application of gait analysis to legal matters. But what you're saying actually goes back, is effectively a couple of, you know, 2,500 years to when, you know, things were in humankind were being codified and first transcribed in terms of recognizing how people's movements were individual to them, or how the people could be recognized, should I say, by their movements, whatever those movements would be. And when we're talking about gait, we bear in mind we're talking about head, shoulder, arms, torso, legs, feet. We're not just talking about the feet itself. And then we've got a whole bunch of things wrapped in there about how we move. So, for example, when we walk, can you move your head slightly? Does a person's elbow tip out to the side? Routinely, no, it doesn't. Not voluntarily, anyway. So what will happen when we move is that other things kick in. For example, arm movement is hugely important in maintaining balance when we walk. And we look at the aspects of magnitude and a whole bunch of other things, not just magnitude, as a form of measurement, how we look at these things. But therein lies some of the difficulties that arise, is that how do we measure things? and how accurate are they? And in the current application of forensic gait analysis in the legal system, whether that's inquisitorial or the adversarial system we have in England and Wales or Scotland and Northern Ireland as well, is it's what we call class characteristics. So you're talking about probability. And one of the difficulties we have with CCTV, and we don't have the biometric uses of gait analysis in our legal system in the UK yet. It is being used elsewhere, but it's not being used in the UK, and that will, there'll be other things that have to determine whether that takes place, and that's down the pipe with all the AI and all the other stuff that we'll see. So in terms of going back to Linda's specific point, is that this has been evolving for 2,500 years in terms of it being codified and transcribed in some shape or form. Shakespeare was the classic for, I mean, many people don't realise what was the first folio, 36 plays, was it? Correct me if I'm wrong. 21 of those have reference to gait as some shape or form as an identifying factor of an individual.
It's amazing. Yeah, absolutely. Well, actually, it sort of links in with what you were saying about Anthony Hopkins. I mean, you think about Hannibal Lecter. Very much, he stood very straight. His gait was very defined. He was a very precise man, and it sort of comes from that the character of him. I know Anthony Hopkins used to say that it started his when he was trying to get into character. It started with how he thought he would stand, and that famous scene when, you know, Clarice Starling first sees him and he's standing there and he's very erect, and then he walks in these very precise small steps. And it is something about the gait that they thought was part of his character.
Yes, also very interesting is Anthony Hopkins never points. And naturally, I mean, whether he's going by this rule book or what, I don't know, but he never points. He always uses his second finger. And you'll see it as Hannibal. When he's pointing, he's never direct the index finger. He's always the second finger. Also, part of the training was, you know, a character that rings the body. They're twisting all the time, either when they're very nervous. And I mean, now, because of today, I've started to think about all this, because there was also, when I was at drama school, an actor who had an appalling stammer and Tourette's. So you'd be at lunch with him, and you'd go, hey, and his whole body would twist and turn. He gets on stage and he's completely still. Never, ever has any form of twitch. And so over and over again, I'm now beginning to think, you know, we'll all be looking at each other going, my God, he's got a bit of a limp. Oh, yes. But right now, there is a situation with a young girl on trial who posed as a young boy and met this girl, took away her glasses because so she couldn't see, and pretended that she was a boy. But the mother, and so you say, is it because she's more experienced, grown up, spots this purportedly young boy and says, no, that's not a boy, it's a girl. So I think those signs, I mean, you've cracked it over there. I think you're brilliant.
So, let's pick that up because it's really interesting. So this is really at the heart of it, is the fact that for a lot of us, the question would be, how Sherlock Holmesian is this? You know, in Sherlock Holmes, he sees a footprint, he sees the length of stride, and suddenly he's got the height of the person and loads of characteristics about them. I have a feeling you're about to tell us that that's not the reality, Aidan.
It's funny because there are aspects that are helpful in what he did when you understand the fuller picture, and there are aspects that are then embroidered, and that is a bit where you think, well, hang on, how useful is that? For example, someone who would have a handprint on a mirror, for example, Sherlock Holmes would say, well, actually, that gives indication of their height, with the assumption was that the hand would go out horizontal to the torso, and that onto the mirror to give. So if it was a certain height, you could get an estimation from that. Well, actually, maybe they put their hand up, maybe they reached up or they reached down. Of course, that's. But what would happen in the heat of an event, the heat of a murder or something? You can't really say. So there's some questions there, some embroidery, as I like to call it. But if I give you an example, if I talk about the class characteristics, which means that it's part of a jigsaw, and anyone that knows about investigations, as Cass will know as well as anybody here, if not more so, is that it's a jigsaw of evidence. And if you go back to just the bit about Shakespeare was that he was a great observer. And what does science start with? It starts with an idea, yeah, that then expands out into all the other things that we then need to do to see how much validity can be applied to it. But the idea is where it starts, and then you have a jigsaw of all the other things. If I give you just a quote from Shakespeare, bear in mind he was born in the same year as Galileo, that wonderful scientist, yeah? So you have the more artistic perspective and that going on at the same time in history. I don't know whether they linked up or not, but Shakespeare did disappear for a while to Italy, but that, who knows what happened there. But if I give you a... just look at Julius Caesar, Act 1, Scene 1. "'Tis sinner, I do know him by his gate." If we go to The Tempest, Act 4, Scene 1, "'Highest queen of state, great Juno comes, I know her by her gate.'" And if we go to Love, Labour's Lost, Act 5, Scene 1, "'His humour is lofty, his discourse is peremptory, his tongue filed, his eye ambitious, his gait majestical, and his general behaviour vain, ridiculous, and thrasonical. He is too picked, too spruce, too affected, too odd, as it were, too peregrinate, as I may call it." I mean, that is, I think, is a wonderful description of how a combination of things get used in investigations as a jigsaw to see who is the culprit.
And the more observant of you may have noticed the book that he was reading from was his own fine work, Forensic Gate Analysis, available in all good bookstores. What we're getting at is that gate is individual, but how much can you tell about a person by their gate? Can you tell the gender of a person by their gate?
Yes, I mean, if I said to everybody in here, and there's people walking around, if I said to you, is that a male or female walking? Pretty much everybody I would expect could say, yes, that's a male, yes, it's a female. If one then asked perhaps a slightly different question and say, how do you know it's a male or female? That might be a slightly more difficult question to answer. And very brief, that relates to shoulder and to pelvic movement in the general sense.
Okay, so those are the sort of things you're looking at. You're talking about the head movement, the arm movement, pelvic movement, length of stride. I'd imagine the toes turning in or out, is that distinctive?
I think the way to try and view it is that our bodies move in three planes, yeah? We have a frontal plane, which is the longitudinal bisection from the side, not the front. Actually, it's a misconception word. Coronal plane is a better word. The sagittal plane, which is looking from the front or the rear, and we've got a transverse section, so looking from above. And then what we see in those different planes are different things. For example, someone with bow legs, you wouldn't really look for that on a side view. Someone with hyperextended knees, you wouldn't look at it on a front view. And someone who's got very turned out feet, you wouldn't necessarily look that from a side view. But if you saw it on a side view, it kind of tells you that piece of footage or whatever it would be you're observing. If you're seeing very abducted feet, turned out feet, that from a side view, that will tell you that that's likely to be a large magnitude of abduction turning out of the feet if you're observing it on a side view, because you're breaking into another body plane. So when you would flick that around and look at it from the front or the rear, you would see, obviously particularly from the front, that the feet are turned out much more. But what we have to be careful of here, and this is where it's what's crucial, I think, with all forms of not just science, but particularly with forensic science, given what its use is that you have to be aware of what the limitations of something are. That's absolutely crucial. And being able to state what they are, or if you don't know what the limitation of something is, stating it. Where experts sometimes get themselves into difficulties is when they're witness box in the heat of the moment. They might have been there 1 or 2 or 3 days. Sometimes it can be even 4 or 5, as I've had on one occasion, not often, thankfully, where you are being stretched with the use of language, where each word in a sentence can carry a different connotation in law. So the conversation we're having here today would be we might use things in a slightly different way than if we're actually in the courtroom because of the consequences of how that gets taken forwards and in the whole process that's actually taking place, whether that be an adversarial system, which is combative, or an inquisitorial system. So we look at everything from head to feet. We look at it from a triplanar perspective. Being able to measure all of those components in an individual is difficult, but the more unusual features that exist, the more unusual characteristics that exist, bear in mind you're not only getting what you might call an equal addition when you start to multiply different biometrics together, which would go, which brings in other areas of expertise beyond your own, is that becomes a logarithmic addition, without getting too technical on it.
Cass, this sounds pretty useful for a detective out there. Do you remember making use of it? Was it around? Was it evolved?
My first ever experience with, not technical gait analysis, but it was about the feet and do those shoes fit on those feet? And it was a murder between a guy, they'd both been drinking quite a bit, and one guy, he was about 6'2", and he stabbed the other guy, but he got blood on his trainers. So he swapped his trainers with the guy he'd killed. He was about size 13 or 14 foot, massive feet. Unfortunately, the trainers that he put on were about a size 10, so his feet were like that. But then we spoke to, at that time it would be a scientist, but they said that what we do is you put fingerprint ink on their feet, bits of A4 paper around the charge room, and get them to walk on those, and then they can look at the way the feet display. Well, this chap, we laid it out and off he went, but unfortunately we forgot to tell him to stop and he carried on walking around the charge room and there was these black fingerprint footprints, and the old desk sergeant wasn't too happy about it. But actually in that job we were able to, we got other shoes from his address, and they were able to say that, yeah, that's his feet that have been in those shoes. DNA in those days wasn't as great, and also because of the bacteria and stuff inside the soles of the feet, that sort of kind of destroys it. Moving on from that, it was actually through the Chartered Society of Forensic Sciences and meeting Wesley Vernon that I got to know about your discipline and how it could be involved. Because one of the problems is that SIOs don't tend to know about outside expertise. They see science as, well, it's forensic science, it's DNA, chemistry or whatever. And it's only through, like, if one person gets used in a case, that information gets passed on, but it doesn't get passed on sort of nationally. And so it was through that dealing with a case where there was CCTV and the guy walked with a limp, and then it was said, well, you might be worth contacting one of these experts who's a podiatrist.
Yeah. Well, that's the magic acronym there. It's CCTV. I mean, that changed everything, right? So you talk about 2,500 years of looking at gait, but really it's not until CCTV was widely used that this became evidence that would be used in court. Is that right, Hayden?
It is. I mean, the question is there anything, I've been asked a number of times before, was it something that was created intentionally? No. And also, I put the question back to someone and said, well, actually, is there anything truly new that occurs, or are new things created out of things that are already in existence? And this certainly falls into the latter category there. We're talking about video image analysis, you're talking about gait analysis, you're talking about the use of CCTV. And the evolution of forensic gait analysis was based very simply, I'll keep it short, was I was at an expert witness conference at Dean's Yard, near Dean's Yard Conference Centre. Everyone there, from accountants to zoologists, a chap comes that talks to me in November 99 over a coffee, an image analyst, a former group captain in the RAF, just chatting generally. And his exact words were, he said, oh, we've got a case at the moment that's more medical than what we do. He said, can I have your card? I said, yeah, sure. I didn't think any more of it. And then in January 2000, I got a phone call at practice at Harley Street. And the receptionist said, oh, Mr. Kelly, she said, there's a DS Wolf Pickles from the flying squad like to speak to you. And I'm thinking, Christ, what have I done now? And that's how it was born. It said what happened is a series of jewellery robberies had gone on in over an 18-month period or so in southeast England. And he said, we've got a lot of analogue tapes, videotapes in those days. Can you help us? I said, well, bring them along, we'll have a look. Because I'd spent a lot of time as my clinical career has not just been in foot surgery as a former dean of podiatric surgery, but also particularly in sports biomechanics and being with football and World Cups and all this other stuff. So there was a deep basis, and I'd already given evidence a number of times in court in the civil matters, personal injury claims. So I said, what's there? And that's how it evolved. And we really said, well, we're looking at a series of unknowns, which is a person in the robberies. And then we're comparing that to some other footage, which was known footage of the individual. So you've got your scientific, you've got your unknowns, you've got you're comparing unknowns with unknowns, and then comparing those unknowns to the known. And then going through what we call an ACE process of analysis, comparison, evaluation. But the first test you have to do is to determine whether that footage is suitable for analysis. Is the quality good enough? in lay terms, that would be, is it too grainy or not? But there's other things that affect things. Usually lighting is the biggest factor that can ruin something.
So, to start mentioning Wolf there, I used to play rugby with him, so it's a question sort of orientated around that. From an old injury, some days I'll get pain in my knee and it actually causes me to turn one foot out to sort of alleviate the pain. Do you have problems with that sometimes? Because some days it will be fine and other days, so if you're looking at video, one day this guy could have a limp, but the next day he may not have it. Do you ask for medical histories sometimes?
Yeah, I mean, you'd want to have a look at the medical records if they're available. Judges are notoriously reluctant to place court orders to do that for a whole bunch of reasons, but they will do so. But when there are medical records that are accessible, then yes, you want to look at them to see what injuries have occurred, how long ago, if any, were they recent, and crucially, are they relevant as well?
So that the CCTV and the quality of it is crucial. I mean, I presume, Linda, you were writing about this, I think. I mean, certainly back then, in the 80s, there wasn't a lot of CCTV, and what there was wasn't great quality.
Yeah, but also, you know, we're so used to listening to virtually every crime, true crime. They're always going, the CCTV camera was there, we've got CCTV footage here. Well, if you just go back to about 1985, and they had a few on the roads, you know, for speeding, whatever. But the reality is now you've got doorbells, you've got them, house security, so you have an awful lot of footage coming in. And so I'm dealing with Jane Tennyson in around 1985. And there's one security camera up, but the footage that's been put in is by a rank amateur. And it's like, how do you get from that footage? Was there somebody at the house across the street between 6 p.m. and 3 p.m.? And it's like, the poor officers got to sit and watch. And in reality, that's what happens. You have teams of people sitting for hour upon hour watching, because 1 second, you may miss a vital piece of evidence, you know, just a car coming into view. And so, you know, everything is very complex now. But I have a big question for Hayden. Have you ever had a case that only your evidence was able to prove a guilty verdict?
Good question. The answer to that, I don't know. And the reason you don't know is because when cases are conducted, experts, broadly speaking, not in all aspects, but broadly speaking, they're kept separate. So I don't mean just separate from the area of specialisms, kept separate from the other side, or the lawyers are kept separate, and there's linkages with law enforcement or defence barristers, whoever's instructing you, that are kept at arm's length for very good reason, because you don't want your mind polluted by information to create a bias that otherwise wouldn't be there. So the answer to the question is, I don't know. I do know that there's been cases where it's been hugely influential, as has been said to me afterwards, in terms of the significance of it. But like every case, as Cass will know, you won't always have the same things available. You may not always have fingerprints. You may not always have a shoe print. You may not always have CCTV of the matter. For example, DNA. Let's say there's an incident at Victoria Station, for example, and someone's scarf is off, and they pull him in, and he said, "Yeah, I was there. I was there 3 weeks ago. I dropped a cigarette. My DNA be on it. Of course it will." So what you've then got is a situation, bear in mind what most people won't be aware of, is a crime scene, you may have hundreds or thousands of different types of DNA. So what it then comes to is, can you put the person there at the time of the event? Not can you put the person at Victoria Station? Can you put them there at that time? So in that instance, the CCTV footage of their gates, if there's anything particularly distinctive, may or may not, yeah, there's two sides to a coin, be useful for a prosecution, or it might actually swing the other way to support the person says, no, I wasn't there at that time. And there's been cases where it's, I've had to help people say, no, the person did the event is not the driver. The person that did the event is the other person. And because phones can only take things so far, it hinged on something really quite important. So the driver was saying, I didn't do it, as it apparently turned out. The person did it said, no, I was the driver. So there was a clash there. But the gate evidence showed quite clearly that the person who committed the offence was not what the police initially thought was. They thought they got it round the other way. They thought the driver was the perpetrator as opposed to the other way around.
Yeah. I mean, Victoria Station is a good example, actually, here, I think, because, you know, you've got a long shot camera, let's say, of the concourse. You can't see their face. So there's nothing you can, you know, or they're wearing a cap or something like that. It's so often that's the thing you can't see. You can't identify them by that. So you've got to go on something like the gate. And I suppose what the question would be is what are the fallibilities of a CCTV camera, even these days? I mean, do you get foreshortening? Do you get, I mean, how much can you actually tell if it's at the wrong angle? How challenging is that aspect?
The lighting is the key thing, along with frame rate and resolution. Those are the three factors that will determine usually whether it's of any use or not. You can do enhancement work with it, both linear and non-linear, without getting too technical. So, for example, contrast is a linear adjustment, and you get gamma, which is a non-linear adjustment. So those are technical terms. But you can do things that can enhance footage that don't take it to a point where you distort it. And the kit that's used by the image analysts will tell you when you're reaching a distortion point. So it will be determined on a case-by-case basis. Most of the footage now is much more usable than it once was. But bear in mind, just because footage is digitized, it doesn't get away from all the things that the analog brought as that were problematic. And that every tool you have has failings within it. You just have to make sure that you're using it in the right way. But bear in mind, with gate analysis, it was used at a higher bar evidentially, first of all, in 2000, that case that was on the front page of Independent across the media platforms with the armed robbery. But it's also been subsequently used, which was the first case where it was helped to find somebody. So, for example, you might have a series of pieces of footage. I'll give you an example where you're shown five pieces of footage for an incident, and the officer said, what can you tell us about it? And the first thing I said to them, well, actually, you do realise you've got at least three people here. You had hyperextension of the knee that I mentioned earlier, you had turned out feet, and you had bow-leggedness in lay terms. Those features didn't coexist on those pieces of footage. So you know that you've actually got at least three people there. So how was that useful? It allowed them to shut down different avenues that they were looking at and hone in to other things. So there's huge time saving.
Yeah.
How do you... I mean, like, scientists will use like a likelihood ratio, and I believe in the Netherlands, for forensic gate analysis, they use that principle, but it's different over here. Because by its nature, it's a kind of subjective discipline. So how do you avoid biases in making your calculations or...
Well, first of all, likelihood ratios are problematic in the courts, and the courts here don't like them, if I put it in lay terms. They don't. And there's reasons, because they get misused by people trying to use them, and they get misinterpreted by people trying to understand them. And that's the legal system decided that's not what it wants to do in most cases, not in all subjects, but it's problematic. You're quite right that, you know, we're talking about probabilities, and probabilities mathematically are anything between 0 and 1, so we're talking percentage accuracies if you take that a step further. I won't get too technical about that side of it as to what other nations do, but yes, you're right, it's subjective assessment, and there's an honesty factor here, there's a probity factor about experts. You know, where you have a requirement upon you with duties and responsibilities to do what's right. The difficulty of an expert is they're set up, in my view, of having given evidence in the criminal courts for 23 years as an expert. In my view, they're set up to fail. And that's not for when people get things wrong and do things they shouldn't. The expert's duty and responsibility is to the court. You see, but in an adversarial system, the barristers are each other's throats to win, yeah? But the expert's duty, about who's instructing you, about who's paying your invoice, is duty to the court. And that's right. But it puts them in a difficult position because, doesn't concern me, but for some people think, well, if I don't skew the report in a certain way, I'll use that word, they won't instruct me again and I won't get paid. So they're strapped between that rock and a hard place where they have to determine themselves how they're going to get out of it. And when people ask me that question, I say, if you feel like that, don't do the work.
Can I just ask you something? Right now, again, if you watch true crime programs like I do, I'm addicted to them all, you watch TV crime series, you're very aware how often they say that the perpetrator is very forensically aware, i.e. they've worn rubber gloves, they've kept no fibers left, they've had a suit like, you know, from the DNA, whatever. So if you are now aware of your work, you think, right, I'm going to wear very heavy boots, I'm going to pad out my shoulders, stomach, and put a helmet on. Now, with all that disguise, are you still able to say and describe that person, or could they hoodwink you?
Yes, they can alter, people can alter the way they walk, but can they do it continually? That's the question. There's one other example I'll give you. There was, I won't say where, there was a bombing that occurred in a government building, not in the UK. And I was asked to look at it post-event. And the reason why was this person walks into a building, up a staircase, jacket and tie on, takes out their target, a minister, along with seven others, as a suicide bomber. The resolution was, and the frame rate was in lay terms, good. I'm looking at thinking, I can't see any suicide vest underneath this person's white shirt and their jacket they were wearing. And within about 20 seconds of looking at, it was about maybe 40 seconds of footage, I said to him, oh, look. Oh, yeah, I said, if you had a spotters that were trained, or your CCTV operator was trained, or you had an alert system through a biometric system being in use, you could pick this person up. Two reasons. One, people in that building who wore a jacket and tie were only very senior, so why wasn't it recognised? It got missed. That was the first thing. The second thing was there was loss of arm swing on one side. Now, for those that will know, loss of arm swing on one side is a, can be a very early indicator of Parkinson's disease. It can indicate other things as well. So when a person walks into a room, seeing their GP, their physiotherapist, podiatrist, whoever it might be, they'll be looking what's going on as the person walks in. They'll see things if they have a training in gait or an experienced in gait, and they'll see that loss of arm swing that's not there. The person themselves at that stage won't even know the arm swing isn't there. Okay, it's gone. Why is that relevant? It's relevant because in this particular case, that person was just holding themselves, their arm, not in a squeezed manner against one side, but just at the point where it wasn't moving. Their arm wasn't moving on that side. Why is that? Why is that? So from an alert point of view, with layers of security take place, if people were trained in that aspect, they could have gone in and spoke to that person. What would be the outcome? Well, the event may have still have occurred, but the person wouldn't have reached their target.
Mm. That's fascinating. Oh, yeah.
There's something for a book.
Yeah.
Exactly. Yeah. I'll drop that down.
Yeah. Make a note of that one. So just to be clear, we're comparing unknown with known. Okay. CCD. Where are you getting the known from? Where are you allowed to get it from? Are you asking them to do what Cass said, and they're walking around the police station, and you're.
It can be very, it can be a custody speech, which is if someone's been arrested or they've been asked to attend for an interview. But there may also be public CCTV where the person themselves doesn't dispute that it's them going into Tesco's on Sunday morning or wherever it is. There's other footage of a more surveillance nature where an individual may say, that's not me. In that case, that can't be used as no material. But the person who's walking into Tesco's on a Sunday, well, actually, was it you or was it not you, for example, that is... if that with certain tests, that's satisfactory for known material.
Yeah. Do you ask, with what you said earlier about the change in the walk, if they've deliberately put one, for example, a detective might bring you something and say it's basically just the scene and then some other video they've taken for the purpose of you to examine. But do you ask them, look, go back, pick him up and track him back so I can see how he was walking 5 minutes down the road, sort of.
Very much so. Yeah. Yes. Yeah. Very much so.
So suddenly, the detective's job is to go and find as much CCTV as he can all the way down the road. So you're going to houses, I presume, now, and going for, to try and get doorbell cameras?
Doorbell cameras are used an awful lot these days.
There was one example that I won't mention the case name. It's too high profile, I think. But where I was asked to look at some material, and I said, look, we need a front view of this person to see what the true magnitude of the abducted feet is. That was one feature of them we were looking at. And I said, look, the person walks away from that building. They walk down that road to a T-junction and turn right. If you go down there and there's a camera, we'll get that bit of footage. They went down there, but at the time they said, oh no, we've been down there already. Da di da di da di da, in the MIT room, murder investigation room, looking around, thinking, okay. The SAO said to me, we'll come back to you, Hayden, and they did within a few days. Went down there again, checked again. There was footage down there. A camera on a retired policeman's house caught someone walking a side view of them, who then got into a car. So what you then do, you're using one tool to get to another forensically. So the car people get onto the car, they say, oh yeah, that's car X, da-di-da-di-da-di-da, and then they can go to that vehicle and see, right, how many of those vehicles in that area, da-di-da-di-da, and so the process, you get down that pipe of narrowing it down to what you're trying to find.
What about what you're walking on, i.e. sand, different, do you have to take into account the different surfaces that somebody may be walking on, because that would change the way they walk slightly?
Certainly surfaces are forgiving, such as the soft part of a sandy beach. Well, you'll see the person walk differently, as we all would, than the wetter sand nearer the water's edge. On hard surfaces are pretty much hard surfaces. Camber can influence things, perhaps not as much as people might think, unless it's a particularly extensive camber. And also body weight, if someone's carrying a weight, and there's work that's done to show the effect of loading and unloading the body. I think about a rucksack, that kind of thing. Oh, the rucksack will affect the way they walk, but it might do. Pinning their arms to their sides might affect the way they walk, like kids do when they mess around. Their center of gravity will alter. The question is how much an effect it has, and what you want to see is what Cassie just said, is you want to see what's happening maybe before and after that particular element, that scene. Are there any alterations in how that person's walking by the other things that are affected by them? So, for example, are the shopping bag they're carrying, is it affecting the other factors of their gait or not?
That's all we've got time for, I'm afraid. But thank you very much to everyone. And if you want to know more about this, then I heartily recommend, come on, hold it up, Hayden's book, Forensic Gait Analysis. Oh, look at that. And from Linda, Cass and I, we'll be back with more news about a full series of Listening to the Dead, which will be coming soon. And until then, it's goodbye from me.
Goodbye from Linda.
Goodbye from me.
Goodbye from Hayden.
Thank you very much. Bye.
Been listening to Crime Conversations, recorded live at CrimeCon, partnered by CBS Reality. For more information on future CrimeCon events, visit crimecon.co.uk.